All right, let's start with something a little offbeat, which is maybe a 3 or 4 or 5 minute discussion here to start with. From here to the end of the book of Acts is going to be 6 chapters worth of Paul's trials. In what other part of the Bible do you see lots and lots of detail on a trial? Do any other trials come to mind besides Paul's? Job's, yeah, I'm talking about a court trial. Yeah, no, Jesus, of course. Much of your gospel, several chapters in each, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, contain the details of his trial. Now, the Bible is famously concise in treating things in small sections most of the time. The fall of man takes one short chapter, and the flood takes one chapter, and the spread of man throughout the world takes one chapter, but there's several chapters in each of the Gospels about the trials in court of Jesus Christ, and now we're getting 6 chapters on Paul's trials. Let's discuss for a second. You're a Christian, and you're going to be reading the Bible the rest of your life. What do you do with this section of the Bible, these court trials that take up so much of the New Testament? Why are we even going to be reading this? What are we supposed to get out of it, that this lawyer said this and that lawyer said that, and here's how it ended up? What great spiritual blessing are we supposed to get out of that? Let's talk for a second. Take a 30,000-foot flight. Let's start with this question. Matthew 26 through 28 and Acts chapter 23 through 28 and all the court trials, who typically in reality reads those? Is it typically unbelievers who read them, or is it typically fringe Christians who read them, if you want to put it that way? Is it denominational folks who are very familiar with these court trials, or is it a quote-unquote advanced Christian who's typically reading these trials and all the details in them? It's an experienced Christian, isn't it? So as you're looking at this, there's many things to take out of it. One of the things, of course, in the life of Christ is all the suffering that each detail gets across. The arrogance of the Jews and the humiliation he had to endure and all these sorts of things. But that isn't particularly the point with Paul, the suffering that he's going through, although he is, because there were more painful things he went through that were dismissed in 1 or 2 verses. But I think one of the things that we get when we're looking at the trials of Christ, the trials of Paul, the court trials, and the book of Revelation, is we understand how to deal with the world. The book of Ephesians, for example, tells us how to prepare our minds to love God and love one another. But what happens when you go out there and live in the practical world, and how do you deal with them? You can see, as you go through Acts 23 through 28, the Lord conducting the white pieces, these being Paul and his fellow Christians. You can see the devil controlling the black pieces, and those are who here? Satan is controlling what human beings in Acts 23 through 28? The Jewish leaders, and then there's a person watching. If you ever go to a chess tournament, you'll see a couple grandmasters sitting there, and then there's a whole bunch of the rest of us ham and eggers standing around trying to guess their moves, and we're in the audience. Who's in the audience in Acts 23 through 28? The Romans. Now, that isn't to say that they're absolutely fair judges, but they are typical of average human beings the last 5,000 years. And so the war is real, as the book of Revelation gets across, that there really are spiritual beings, good and evil, and there really are moving people around like pawns. And is it good to understand what the evil ones and the audience is thinking? When grandmasters play a world championship match, there's probably no way to get across how carefully they study each other's histories and each other's strategies. Paul said about the devil, we're not ignorant of his devices. And so as you go through here, every Christian who's ever been persecuted, especially in a foreign land, can take comfort in the fact that people who are unfair to them, people have been unfair to the best of them. So we're prepared and braced and we're strengthened for conflicts with the world. All right, so general comments or questions on that? These trials are extremely valuable if you ever plan on dealing with unfairness in the world. And do you ever deal with people who are unfair because you're a Christian? So those are the kind of principles we're looking for here. Now, verse 30, the chapter break should have actually taken place before verse 30. Now, on the morrow, after we talked about the riot in the last chapter, because he would have known the certainty whereof he was accused of the Jews, this is the chief captain, he loosed him from his bands, and he commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear, and he brought Paul down and set him before him. So again, you can have this image of we're the white pieces, and the devil has false religious leaders as the black pieces, and you can see the Roman as the people out there who aren't on either side watching this. Now, that's verse 30, so let's read verses 1 through 5 here as he goes into this. Senior? So that's a boring introduction to the trial or a dramatic introduction to the trial? Okay, so the chief captain wants to know what's going on here because it doesn't make any sense they'd be rioting over religious doctrines like this. And in reality, that's not psychologically what they are arguing about here. Usually when people are fighting, they're fighting about something under the surface. And the same goes here. But when the captain wants to know the certainty of what's going on, so have we had riots in America lately? Imagine you're a mayor and you have to get to the bottom of it. And imagine that you just walked into it yesterday and you didn't know a single thing about the background. Does this chief captain know anything about the Nazarene sect? No. So imagine you walk into Charlotte, North Carolina or whatever, and there's a big riot going on, and this policeman shot that person, and these people are knocking over buildings over here. And you come in, you say, all right, each of you give me a couple of representatives, and you sit down, we're going to get to the bottom of this. That's the chief captain's perspective. Is that also the person in the world's perspective when a non-Christian is listening to you and an unbeliever or something like that? He just doesn't know what's going on, so he wants to know the truth. He says, and he brings him in and he sets him before him. Understand again how nervous this is for Paul. We've used the illustration a couple times for years and years and years. I didn't understand why baseball players got so emotional about the Hall of Fame. Like they haven't given enough autographs in their lives, but they get the call and they're on TV and they literally start bawling to go into the Hall of Fame, even though they've already played 10,000 games in front of people chanting their name. And I didn't get it until they put a TV show on and then they showed the inside of the Hall of Fame. And the pomp and the circumstance and the setting, it's kind of like when Nehemiah was describing about King Ahasuerus, and he was talking about the way the banners were of silk and the utensils were of gold. And when you actually see the inside of this Hall of Fame and the parties that go on and the people who fawn, the atmosphere is a huge part of it. Can you imagine going before the Supreme Court, what the atmosphere would be like? You could cut the air with a knife. So this just says Paul was set before them. And it's left us to either subconsciously or consciously infer what it would have been like to be formally arraigned before a Roman captain. Would that be one of the best days of your life or one of the worst, to be standing before one of these Roman thugs, you know, with a sword on his belt and so forth? So anyway, so Paul starts talking. And he's earnestly beholding the council. How many people in the Sanhedrin, by the way? 70. How many people in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Nine
people in the Supreme Court. They need to fill one. But if you looked into John Roberts' eyes, would you find him intimidating, do you think? Here are 70 guys with decades of learning behind them, and Paul's on the spot, is the point that we're getting at, and he's earnestly beholding them. I can never remember whether it's John Knox or who wanted to give a lesson in a sermon in a really important situation, and he fasted for 3 days beforehand, and when he got up, he looked at the congregation, and people gasped, according to the denominational history books, and some people got tears in their eyes before he said a word because of the look on his face. Have you ever had that happen where a person gets up and their demeanor brings the whole place to where you could hear a pin drop? So what does it mean that Paul is earnestly beholding the council? He's leaning into the microphone here, isn't he? He's not sitting, I think it was Dave Shipp who once said, when you're singing, you want to be up on your toes and not leaning back. Well, this is Paul. So he says, men and brethren, I've lived in all good conscience before God to this day, as a Christian and as a Jew. Again, what's the function of your conscience? There's such a thing as a conscience that has been misinformed, and a person can be obeying their conscience and displeasing God. But a conscience is good for one thing, according to Romans 2, which is what? Yeah, it tells you when you're violating your own beliefs. It does that without fail. Can you argue with your conscience? You can try. Do you still feel guilty after you've done something really bad, no matter how much you try to paper it over? Does your conscience ever cut you slack over a little sin? If God is anything like your conscience, he doesn't overlook any kind of sin, does he? He forgives it, and he works with you on it, but he's aware of total reality, just like your conscience is aware of total reality at every step of the way. So, he's lived in all good conscience, he says. Verse 2, and the high priest Ananias, it doesn't say anything typically with the Bible, it doesn't tell you, Luke doesn't step back and say Ananias did this because he was an evil man. It's kind of up to you to decide what you think about that. Paul said, I've lived in good conscience, and then the guy who was ruler in the proceedings command him to be hit in the mouth for saying that. What do you think about that situation? Is there any situation where you, as judge of a council, would order that done, or would you let the guy defend himself? What if you're talking about a serial murder? Would you make him shut up while we crucified him, or would you allow him to cast a defense? Bill?
They're interested in his defense.
Precisely. This is not going to be a debate. This is not an exchange of ideas. This is for us to, you know, give ourselves a rationale for punishing you. Now, by the way, who's in charge, the chief captain or the Sanhedrin? The typical setting is that the council be down here in a lower bowl and the Roman soldiers would be up watching on a balcony. And I think it does say later that the chief captain commanded to run down and save Paul in the middle of this thing. So the Romans are letting the Jews hold their own little court here. That's pretty generous of them, wouldn't you say? But the Romans were in the habit of doing a lot to try to compromise with the Jewish leaders. So not only would this guy hit somebody if he didn't like what he said, but he hits him in the mouth, you know, like, shut up, we're going to shut up your mouth. Did you ever have a grandma who used to use the expression, we'll wash your mouth out with soap? Still do that? Yeah, so you'd have the soapy taste in your mouth reminding you, I guess, not to use the bad words again. Now, Paul says, what in return? Then said Paul unto them, God will smite you, you whited wall. Now, here's another interesting little question for discussion as we're thinking about it. What did Jesus do when he was blamed like this in law?
He was silent.
How silent? Like a lamb going to the shear. Why doesn't Paul imitate that? Just for our own thought here. Full of interesting question in these court trials, isn't it? What do you say, Mike?
Paul was not his death on the cross.
Exactly. Their fates are different. Christ wanted to be crucified. His life wasn't taken from him. He laid it down willingly. The moment was there for Jesus to let this whole thing run its course and then for him to be crucified, and that was the intent. Is that God's intent with Paul? No, his services are still going to be required for a while. So he asserts his right, says he, as of course there's nothing wrong with doing. He says, God will smite you, you whited wall. Do you sit to judge me after law and you command me to be smitten contrary to the law? this is very similar to the way it's said in the style of an Old Testament prophet. I jotted down a passage here, 2 Chronicles chapter 18. Mr. Franklin, could you turn over there for us, please? In 2 Chronicles chapter 18, about verses 22 through 24, Zedekiah is one of the lying prophets before Ahab, and the Lord's prophet Micaiah tells him that. This is the story about the council before God sends a spirit to forward these prophets in their lying. And verses 22 through 24 is a very similar situation. Go ahead, Mike.
All right, to your prophets. The Lord has declared disaster concerning you. Then Zedekiah, the son of Kenaniah, came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, why, which way to you? And Micaiah said, behold, you shall see on that day when you go into an inner chamber to hide yourself.
Pretty similar style, right? Zedekiah comes up and he punches him in the face and says, okay, Micaiah had said, the spirit is with me and here's a vision from God and it proves these prophets are liars. Then one of the prophets comes up and smacks him in the face and said, tell me, which way was the spirit working for you that time? as though Micaiah wouldn't be getting hit if he was one of God's favorites. And then Micaiah's response is, you'll see when, look, friend, you will understand which way the Spirit was working with me when you are cowering in a cellar. That's almost worse than not knowing the details, isn't it? But that's what he tells him. So Paul answers in Old Testament prophet style. Mike?
All that he's speaking of is...
many places. But yeah, you want to read that for us?
There's a dispute between men, and they come into court, and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty. And if the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence. Certainly beat somebody.
The whole structure of witnesses and everything in the book of Deuteronomy had the idea that a defendant had the right to defend themselves. That wasn't the case in all governments. A lot of times you were there and you weren't allowed to speak and weren't deemed worthy of speaking. But the old law reads like a bill of rights for those people who are not in power. And there in many other places it says, no, we're going to have witnesses. We're going to have an exchange of information. And if the thing be sure and the event be known, then you will punish. And so when Paul says you're commanding me to be hit contrary to the law, is he right? Yeah, this is supposed to be the high priest here. He's supposed to know more about the old law, be more in tune with it than anybody alive. And instead, he's doing exactly the opposite of its intent. So Paul says this, and they who stood by, they gasp and say, how can you talk to God's priest that way? And Paul says, well, I didn't know that he was the high priest. Exodus 22 contains a passage, don't speak evil of God or the ruler of your people. In other words, respect authority. And so Paul says, I wasn't trying to challenge authority. Now, it's interesting, if he had this one back, he wouldn't have said it. So is he inspired right here? When Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, it will be given you in the hour you need it what words to say, that has the idea that the default situation was you were talking on your own until God needed to intervene. So Paul's obviously talking on his own here, using his own logic and so forth. Go ahead, Bill. Well, the high priests changed back and forth is one possibility at the Romans' behest. That's possible, and that's the second view that's taken of this, is that Paul's being kind of ironic. Just my own sense of how Paul usually spoke. If he was being ironic here, says, now, how are you supposed to know that that guy's the high priest? You could have fooled me. If that's what he was saying, I wouldn't think he would then quote a scripture and says, it is written, you shall not speak evil. That's kind of like doubling down on the idea that you shouldn't say this here. So it could be, but that's why I lean towards the idea, okay, he just... for some reason or other, he didn't know that Ananias had the office at the moment. Go ahead, Eric. Yeah, this would be, I think, 18, 20 years later. Other comments? Mike, did you have something?
Bill, you
very well could be right. In either case, it's not critical to the trial. The point is the high priest is doing a good job or a lousy job. Doing a lousy job, that's the point. Okay, Acts chapter 23, verses 6 through 10. So this is an interesting turn that this trial takes that none of the other trials take. It's fascinating to watch. So let's read verses 6 through 10. Who can read that for us? Go ahead, Carl.
But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection the dead, I am being judged." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring them back into the barracks.
Good reading. Okay, so the Pharisees stop on a dime, give you 9 cents change, turn right back around, and now they're Paul's friends. And why is that? Paul had said in Acts chapter 22 he'd seen a vision. and that he had a message from God. Now, supposing that Paul were a real prophet, what implication would that have for the Pharisees? Yeah, they would accept him. What implications would it have for this century-old battle for power between, this is the day's Republicans and Democrats? Eric?
The Pharisees right and Sadducees are wrong.
Pharisees win. This brings 100 years worth of arguing or 50 years or whatever to a screeching halt. Here's a prophet who said we were right the whole time. Do they care about that more or the sect of the Nazarenes more? Yeah, they care about winning this debate, you know, winning the power a lot more. They're even prepared to accept the sect of the Nazarenes if it means they win against the Sadducees. Is that... that's a pretty sad situation, isn't it? But it also shows you, are these leaders right here concerned about justice or what God wants or anything like that? Not at all. So, by the way, it says, the Sadducees say there's no resurrection, there's no such thing as an angel, there's no such thing as a soul. We would say they don't believe in an afterlife. But the Pharisees confess both. Now, there are plenty of deists nowadays who believe that there's a God, but do not believe in an afterlife. And 97.634% of the time, it's because they don't want their moral actions judged. But it's also very common in the Eastern Hemisphere to believe in reincarnation and be an atheist. May you explain that one to me? They think your soul goes into a cycle into another dimension, but there couldn't be such a thing as God. Does that make any sense to you that a human being ought to believe in one of those two things, an afterlife with souls and the devil and the angels and God? Does it make any sense that one should exist and not the other? Men will twist themselves. I mean, that's any person in the street knows that's ridiculous. And yet that's where the smart people, the super smart people, seem to wind up. So Paul perceives that one's a Sadducee and the other is the Pharisee. He cries out in the council and then the whole meeting just falls apart. Is this an honorable thing for Paul to do, or is it a little bit underhanded, or what do you think? Is it fair for him to do that or not? He had the right to say that. Okay, his intent to create a turmoil in the court, what do you think?
Yeah.
Carl votes yes. Andy? Andrew?
I vote yes also. They're shake anyway. And so this was just his way of disrupting the trial.
That's exactly what I've got in my notes, that he knows that justice is not going to be possible, that this is a kangaroo court in the first place, and so how can you destroy a justice process that does not exist in the first place? Spawn was next.
Yeah, I lean more. Sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't. Mm-hmm. I kind of lean towards the man, you don't have to worry.
Matthew 10.
The highest points of the Holy Spirit's tactic here.
That
he knows he's in front of a crowd that doesn't care about listening. So.
Me too. I agree with the thrust of that. And I think the way to look at it that's consistent with the whole book of Acts is that when you've got an important debate between an apostle and a person of the world, that it's inspired unless indicated otherwise. Okay, like Galatians 1 indicates that Peter was not inspired. And I personally take that verses 3 and 4, where he says, I didn't know that he was the high priest, as an indication this part was not inspired. But if it's an ironic thing that Paul was saying, you could never tell that guy was a high priest by the way he's acting, then the whole thing was inspired. But generally, are these apostles doing the work of the Holy Spirit?
Amen.
Of course. See, what you have to understand is that these dialogues in the book of Acts, just like the dialogues in the book of Job, some of which are right and some of which are wrong, are taking place inside their own little nested universe in the book of Acts. The book of Acts is, of course, inspired. But when an individual is saying something, like the blind man in John chapter 9, you then have to take a little bit second look to see whether that person is saying something God wanted him to say at the time. And Bill says, I'd certainly say that Paul was, and I tend to agree with him, with the possible exception of that one verse. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, you know, when you read Paul's opening statement saying, I've lived in all good conscience before God up until this time, and he gets struck on the mouth for that, What could he have said? I mean, there was absolutely nothing Paul could have said, done something worse to him.
Mm-hmm.
So for Paul to then use this ploy of, of course, the council, if they had their way, something rash, but the Romans, who were being more objective.
I like your analogy of the mistrial. If you're in a court run by Saddam Hussein in the first place, causing a mistrial in that context might be a perfectly honorable thing to do. You're not destroying anything because no justice exists in the first place. Go ahead, Eric. Absolutely perfect. Okay, so Eric takes us back to the third base view camera that the Romans are at watching this whole thing and what just happened. The trial, Paul says one thing. And they smite him in the mouth. And then Paul says, you know, there's a doctrinal issue here. And then they all start, you know, furs flying with one another. And what's the Roman captain thinking? Okay, now he has had it demonstrated what these guys are all about. Now he knows what's going on. And you're going to see through the rest of the chapter that he tries to figure out a way to save Paul from this ridiculous situation. That's what the chief captain winds up doing. Okay, other questions or comments? Bill?
Yeah, here, and you don't know whether there were some of the Pharisees that he may have won over during. Could have opened their minds a bit. You
know? Sure.
Actually, this man is standing up for what you just explained. You really believe in this.
Like Gamaliel in Acts 5?
How many of them may have hung around after that? I mean, it's possible.
Sure.
Something like that happened. But we appreciate that.
I've got that in my notes also. So thanks for getting that through. Now when he says, the King James, this old-timey language, says, of the hope and resurrection of the dead am I called in question. What's that mean? I'm being judged today because I believe in an afterlife. Okay, now to what extent is that true? I mean, of course it's totally true. That wasn't the very first thing that Paul would open a sermon with, but it's a big part, right, of going to heaven, of the resurrection, of judgment, and so forth. And so it's interesting that Paul tells the council here, the only reason I'm on trial, the only reason everybody hates me is because I'm preaching an afterlife. And the Pharisees look over at the Sadducees, and the Sadducees look over at the Pharisees, and now this is a much bigger issue than Paul. So, as Bill talks about the inspiration, there couldn't have been possibly a better answer than that, right? So there arises a great cry. Have you ever seen, you know, just a crowd break out in yelling and shouting all at once? So it gets, these are supposed to be Supreme Court justices, and look at how they behave. So there arises a great dissension. The chief captain, fearing lest Paul should be pulled in pieces by them, commanded the soldiers go down and take him by force from among them. What does that mean, pulled in pieces? How would a mob pull you in pieces with their bare hands? The Bible uses these tight, nutrient-dense little phrases to get across tons and tons and tons in just a few words. If you're surrounded by a mob and the policeman on horseback says, the mob is literally going to tear his arms off, how hysterical are they? So, commands the soldiers go down, take him by force from among them and bring him into the castle, going along the lines of Mike's modern legal language, this would be protective custody he is now in. And he remains in protective custody until he goes to Caesar. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, the fact that he had to help was like...
Yeah, right. And
that's not like the Seattle.
Yes. Right. And we're going to see later on, just to move him from one place to another, they get how many soldiers and how many horsemen and how many spears just to move them around. This has become a big deal. Okay, verses 11 through 15. Here's the conspiracy. And Mike, did you have a comment? Or okay, 11 through 15, please.
The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. Then when it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath. Conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, as we are ready to kill him before he comes near. Now, sorry, there we go.
That's okay. All right, so be of good cheer. You're not going to die. And the reason is what? Yeah, you've got your services are still required. You know, that's what it says. As you have testified in Jerusalem, you must also do this at Rome. There are things that need to be done. You can imagine how this sounds to some of the saints. If you take Brother Speck there, for example, who went through that horrific heart procedure, and not knowing about life and death and so forth and where he's headed from here, you can imagine the various thoughts that go through his head when he reads a verse like this that says, your services are still required. Now, sometimes your services, not Bill's, but let's say mine or whoever's, sometimes your services are to die a righteous death. You know, that happened in Acts chapter 12 with the Apostle James. And if that ever happens to a brother that we love, we know that that was the best way they could glorify God, right? But that wasn't true of Paul. He had a lot of work left to do. And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse. Have you ever seen that phrase before? I think that's the only time it occurs in the Bible. They bound themselves under a curse. How would you bind yourself under a curse? Would you pull out a Ouija board and goat's blood and commune with demons? Or how would this be done? Andrew? That's exactly right.
It's some bad thing. You can do some bad thing if I don't fulfill this.
That's exactly the sense of it. And it uses one of the words, I think it only occurs like three times in the Bible. It occurs here in Galatians 1, and I forget whether it occurs one other place in the book of Revelation. It's the word anathema. Let us be anathematized, is what it says by cursing. And that's a word that literally means marked for disposal. Like you go into the hospital, and on the wall they've got this little thing with sharps or biohazard material, and there's only one thing they're going to do with it, and that's dispose of it safely. That's what anathema meant. So when a person back then said, if I don't do this, I am formally praying that God will destroy me for it. Did they mean it? These guys are psycho, aren't they? So they put themselves under a curse that they won't eat or drink. Sometimes you're going in for a procedure and they tell you not to drink anything after midnight, and that immediately makes me thirsty. Makes me thirsty just thinking about it right now. You know, you can't drink anything for 8 hours. Now, supposing you said, I'm not going to have a drink of water till you're dead. These guys are 18 miles past Jupiter, aren't they? So if you had two or three guys from Tacoma, let's say, who you offended in a car accident or something like that, let's take old Olson back here. Now, he's a tough guy, but even he wouldn't prefer to have three of those guys take out a contract on his life. Now, what if there was 40 of them who said, we're not going to take a drink of water until we're standing over your corpse? Would that be a serious situation, or are they just threatening me? So these guys, here we are. It's kind of like a guy movie with car chases or something like that. Paul is just constantly under real fear for his life all the time. And there are more than 40 that made this conspiracy. Can you even visualize 40 people who swore that they wouldn't have a drink of water or a meal until you were dead? Bill?
That's a situation. To be, they rock a woman caught in a very active adultery or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's many examples who are doing what was God intended them to do, and others have other motives. The world is doing, the majority of the world, believing in a God that would create everything. I mean, that the land is behind them, the Don Quixote thing, you know. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, the right, the obligation, so God.
And much worse, well, I mean, there's nothing absolutely worse, but...
I'm saying that we can't be silent. We can't be quiet.
No, that's true.
We need to stand up and speak up, and we think that the Lord's work for us, when we stand for God.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Amen.
The book of Acts starts with the disciples praying for boldness of speech and God granting it. And that's half of what all this is about. So absolutely, this is inspiring to us to speak out for God. And one of the things that makes it easier is, let's just say that you're talking with a militant atheist or something and 9 people in the break room are watching. You're not talking to him, you're talking to them, even though you're looking at him. And if he starts swearing and snarling and stuff, what are they seeing? So you can afford to stay calm and just answer nicely. You're not going to convince him anyway, in all probability. But there are people watching. And so that's an excellent point.
They say, we can't think as they really are.
Yep. A lot of times, if you can just get somebody to state what they really believe, you've won half the fight. Okay, so these 40 guys, they come to the chief priests and elders and said, we've bound ourselves under a great curse. We will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Fine religious specimens, aren't these guys? And verse 15, now therefore you at the council tell the chief captain that he bring him down to you tomorrow as though you would inquire something more completely concerning him. And we, before he even gets close, are ready to kill him. So here again, you've got a situation to where they now conspire with the chief priests who are going to do this. And if you imagine it in terms, I don't know, a Vin Diesel movie or whatever, he's constantly backed into a corner with four guns on him. And how's he going to get out of this? And then something ridiculous happens. How does God get Paul out of this one? That's what we'll study next week. Acts chapter 23 and verse 16. Okay, anything else? That's good for tonight.